From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, he ran charter schools in Traverse City and Saginaw. Now he's going on trial for what the feds say was a slick financial shell game.
He prepaid himself. He advanced himself. And he owed them money back. And so he took some of this construction money from one charter school and paid back the other charter school.
Governor Snyder's new budget will be out this week. State programs are on the chopping block.
We have a $325 million shortfall for the year that we're in right now, the 2015 fiscal year.
Plus death. It's inevitable, but most of us do our best not to think about it unless you're studying mortuary science.
One of the courses I'm taking right now, you have to plan your own funeral.
Those stories and much, much more today for you on Stateside. Death. It's inevitable. But most of us do our best not to think about it and dwell on it, unless you're studying mortuary science.
One of the courses I'm taking right now, you have to plan your own funeral.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, we launch our Living with Death series. Today, changes in mortuary science. Then it's been called the most serious federal criminal case involving a Michigan charter school. We'll learn more later this hour. But first, Governor Snyder is getting ready to deliver his recommended budget for 2015-2016. He'll make his proposals public Wednesday morning in Lansing. With a shortfall in the general fund, early signs point to state jobs and programs on the chopping block. Paul Egan is the Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Cindy.
Get us on the same page. How big are the projected budget shortfalls?
When we talk about the general fund, which is the sort of the main state checking account, which is the one that really is looked at as the main budget, we have a $325 million shortfall for the year that we're in right now, the 2015 fiscal year. And then there's a projected $532 million shortfall for 2016, which is the year that the governor is to hand down the budget for on Wednesday.
And the reason is, and I know, you know, we've had this talked about on Stateside, where it's a surge in Michigan corporations redeeming tax credits, right?
Right. And, you know, the government is saying that it's a little bit of a paradox that as the economy has gotten better, that's enabled more of these tax credits to be cashed in so that and that has put the state in a worse budget position. Of course, normally you would expect as your economy gets better, your budget position would improve as well.
And can you explain that a little more? I think this is very, very confusing for a lot of people who don't understand the intricacies of corporate tax strategies. How is it that, yes, the state's economy is improving, but now we're talking budget shortfalls and cuts?
Well, the way a lot of these tax credits were issued, many of them were to attract new companies, but in a lot of cases, especially during the worst of the recession under Governor Granholm, these were tax credits that were issued to keep, you know, the major auto companies, for example, and other big companies in Michigan, keep them from leaving the state. And the way a lot of these credits work is that if you maintain a certain level of payroll, a certain number of jobs, that you have a tax credit that you can use to offset, not only offset taxes that you would have to pay, but in some cases actually get a tax credit, even if you didn't owe any taxes. And this is where this change in the economy has really had an effect, where the auto sector has actually grown, not in huge numbers of jobs like it once did, but it certainly has grown since the worst of the recession. And so the estimates of even how much the state thought would be cashed in of these credits has increased. And the auto companies are more profitable and have more reason to want to use these tax credits as well.
So it sounds like almost like an incentive clause. Keep plants open, keep jobs in Michigan at a certain level, and you get a reward.
Right. So, you know, and that's been some of the argument. Is this, in some ways, some would argue this is a good problem to have in that it means that those jobs did stay here. On the other hand, it came about in such an unexpected way. This is a year when this governor, who had just been reelected, would have expected to be able to be making investments in a number of programs where, as a result of this budget situation, he's going to be announcing a large number of cuts on Wednesday.
Mm. Well, what are you hearing? What programs and initiatives are likely to see increases increase spending? Let's talk about the winners first.
Well, schools was such a big issue in the election. The governor has said repeatedly that it is a priority of his. And it sounds like in all three areas, Cindy, although perhaps not across the board, but at least in specific areas in all three areas, which is K-12, we're expecting to see increased investment in this grade 3 reading initiative that the governor's been talking about. And that involves spending right from the preschool level up to grade 3 to try to improve Michigan's fairly woeful performance on grade 3 reading proficiency. Then the governor's been talking about this for more than 2 years, the skilled trades initiative. He wants to improve apprenticeship training. He wants to improve skilled trades training. He wants to get away from this idea that every young person needs to be encouraged, that they've got to get a liberal arts education degree, that he wants to get the idea that it's, you know, just as noble and rewarding and financially rewarding to go into the skilled trades. And that's supposed to be an area where we're going to see increased spending. And then thirdly, even universities, the other end of higher ed, we're told, is going to get a boost.
Yeah, and as you say, Paul, all of these have been talked about a lot by the governor's big priorities. And you tell us in your story in today's Free Press, State Department heads have been told to prepare a list of programs they're prepared to cut. So let's talk about losers and cutbacks. Do we have any ideas or anything leaking out as far as what might be on the chopping block?
We haven't gotten too much detail there yet, Cindy. You know, I think where there's a lot of expectation and some speculation is with this huge merger of the Department of Community Health and the Department of Human Services, that there's likely to be some attempt to find some economies there from combining these two huge departments. And these are departments, the Department of Community Health gets over $2 billion of general fund, the Department of Human Services about $1 billion. You know, where this kind of gets complicated in making cuts is that a lot of times these are dollars, state dollars, that get matched and sometimes more than matched by federal dollars. So you can have a case where, you know, if you cut one state dollar, you may lose two or three more federal dollars. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that can kind of make that difficult. We would expect to see, I think, some savings there. The Department of Corrections, you're likely to see some reduction there. They're almost a $2 billion budget that's almost all general fund, and certainly they've been asked to make some savings in the last year or two that is likely to result in another reduction there.
You know, we hear words like economies and redundancies, and doesn't that add up to people losing their jobs? Do we have any sense how many state employees might wind up out of work, or is it more a matter of people maybe being shuffled around or not replaced?
It seems to be more the latter from what, you know, I did talk to the budget director late last week, and he said, you know, absolutely what the state calls FTEs, which are full-time positions, are going to be eliminated. But, you know, the way these things often work in state government is you've got departments that have vacancies that they haven't filled. So you've got jobs that are open now. This job might be eliminated. They might be able to go into another job. And he was not ruling out layoffs, but he said that the state was doing everything they could to minimize whatever number of layoffs there might be. And he genuinely didn't really appear to know for sure as of Thursday, you know, exactly how that would shake out in terms of how many, you know, it was often a case it's where they won't tell you, which he probably wouldn't have told me anyway, but
sure.
I certainly get the sense that he didn't know exactly how many layoffs, but he did seem to stress that they thought it would not be a large number.
You know, Paul, we all know voters are going to be asked to say yes to a sales tax increase and to reconfigure the fuel taxes may to help pay for all those road and bridge repairs that we've been hearing about and talking about. Is there any concern or any thought that voters will not really get this ins and outs of these corporate tax policies? They're going to hear about cutbacks and think, well, so things aren't as good as our governor has been saying. Why should I say yes to this proposal?
Well, I think there could be some of that at work. I mean, there's certainly a lot of negative reaction to this sales tax proposal, and it certainly appears, you know, I'm not going to say it's doomed, but it certainly is off to a rough start, and there's a lot of, I think there's four groups already that have formed to raise money against it. So, sure, I think that may be part of it, but I think it's more a case of, you know, just as much as they tried to put a little bit in there that everybody might like, you know, where you had the road funding, you also have money for schools, you have restoration of the earned income tax credit, you have money for local governments, transit. And so that's, it seems like it's at the same time, it's both part of the appeal and part of the what's not to like about it, because there's also, for every person that might say, yeah, I'd like to see more money spent on schools through that, and I'm willing to pay a little more sales tax for it, you have a large number of people that are saying, look, this is supposed to be a roads proposal. Hmm. I'm willing to pay a little more for the roads, but I don't like all this other stuff that's been thrown in to try to get this through the legislature.
And if the answer in May, the May 5th vote, is no, I'm guessing that would mean a greater strain on an already stressed general fund.
The last 2 years, Cindy, the state has had to put hundreds of millions of dollars into the road budget in order to get the maximum federal match. And when the governor announces his budget on Wednesday for 2016, he'll be announcing general fund money to do that again. You know, the problem as he sees it is that even with the maximum federal match, they're spending, he feels they should be spending about $1.2 billion more on the road. So
yeah.
Absolutely, if this does get turned down, you know, barring some other source of revenue and barring some other great economy that nobody's been able to identify yet in the Department of Transport, either roads are going to take an increasing part of the general fund each year or the roads are going to continue to get worse.
Challenging times for the governor and for his budget director, John Roberts. Paul Egan, Detroit Free Press, Lansing Bureau. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Third grade teacher Melody Arabu has written a new book, her first book, Diary of a Real Bully, with illustrations from fellow teacher Jessica Rohrhoff. Both are teachers at Keith Elementary in Walled Lake. Melody Arabu was named last spring as the Michigan Teacher of the Year, and that's when we first met her. Welcome back to the program, Melody.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Well, you have this platform as Teacher of the Year as a good way to take on the problem of bullying, but I'm wondering, what did you see in your classroom that drove you to write this book?
Yes, well, I actually wrote this book 8 years ago, and it was really just to be able to share a message with my students, and I read it to them in a duotang folder on printer paper without illustrations, just because I wanted them to at least hear the story and identify that within themselves. So, you know, to have it as a real book now is amazing and something very exciting. But it came from a result of the patterns that I saw every year with my third graders. There was something that happened around springtime each year where, you know, some of my nicest, brightest students would start to show some, you know, mean behaviors, some of the mean girl behaviors, and then also just a little more aggression between the boys. And I was just so surprised by that because I don't remember bullying happening in third grade, and I definitely wouldn't expect those students to be doing the bullying. So that really just made me kind of take a look at, you know, why that might be happening. And I started to notice, you know, if you mention the word bully to students, they get very defensive. You know, I'm not a bully, and parents do the same. So that had me kind of thinking about the stereotypes around bullying and how, you know, what you see on TV, those people who are mean all the time and big. And
like the plastics in Mean Girls, the
yes,
Rachel McAdams yes, character.
There's a very specific girl stereotype of the over, you know, self-absorbed, over-popular mean girl who, you know, is controlling and manipulative all the time. And then for the male aspect, there's the big, dumb, mean guy who pushes people into lockers and steals their lunch money.
Sure, they use that person in Glee, that kind of character in Glee.
Yes, yeah. Yes, and I have yet to see a kid like that in 13 years, you know, that exists. So what we really have are very nice kids with good hearts who maybe make bad choices and behave in a mean way sometimes.
So give me, for instance, doing what?
So a lot of exclusion, not letting somebody participate in their group or in their activity, or even just sitting with them. That's a really big thing that starts in third grade. Also name calling, even something as subtle as eye rolling, you know, that just makes somebody feel like you don't care what they're saying. Sometimes it's repeated behavior. Sometimes it's saying something negative to somebody one time that changes the way they feel about themselves. So those are the types of things that I hope to change in kids, is just to let them see that you're definitely not a bully, But when you act like a bully, you have a negative impact on other people. And the beauty of that is that kids do not want to be bullies. They're actually devastated to realize that they've hurt somebody else. Or, you know, how they've impacted somebody else. So that small little shift, instead of saying, you know, a kid is a bully, it's, you know, a kid is acting like a bully, that makes them much more willing to take responsibility for their actions and you know, to apologize and to make that change. Because they know that that doesn't identify, you know, who they are as a person, but it definitely makes them more aware of how they treat others.
Well, and I like the way that in Diary of a Real Bully that you point out that we've all done these things. Everyone has acted like a bully before, even grown-ups.
Yes, that's a huge piece of it, because I want them to see that nobody is immune to this, you know, that there's something in human nature that makes us act that way sometimes. And I think it's happened for so long and goes into adulthood because you don't ever stop to realize that it's bullying and that it's a bully action. So, you know, you think it's okay because you're a nice person, so it's okay to make a comment, it's okay to talk behind someone's back, it's okay to make fun of somebody because, you know, you're a good person inside. So I just want to make a little shift in people's thinking where anytime you make somebody else feel bad, that you're acting like a bully, you know, and again, nobody really wants to be that way. You'll never come across a person who says, yeah, I want to be a bully, or very, very rarely.
And this girl you profile, you kind of make the centerpiece of Diary of a Real Bully, Anna. Using Anna's words, then it sounds like you are trying to, number one, help kids identify the things they do that hurt others, and then give them some ownership and help them own what they're doing, and then show them how to change.
Yes, yes. I just want them to realize that, you know, when they have a negative impact on somebody else, that they can take responsibility for it and make it better. You know, they can definitely change the way that they, you know, treat that person. They can change the way their tone of voice that they use, because tone is a big problem too. A lot of kids have an attitude towards other kids, and even, you know, sarcastic tone or saying something in a mean way has a big impact as well. So I just really want them to become more aware of those things, because they will change them, and I've seen them change them year after year when I can point out to them, hey, how did you make that other person feel? Bad. Okay, so what were you acting like? A bully. Do you want to be a bully? No. You know, I've never had a kid say yes to that. Mm. And then, you know, what would you do next time, or how can you make this better? And they're very receptive to that.
So breaking the bully stereotype is step one, and then it sounds like you're trying to offer the idea of we need to communicate in different and better ways. That needs to be the next step?
Yes, definitely. So there's two pieces to this. You know, there's, of course, the bully piece, and that's mostly to blame, but there's the victim piece as well, and I'm careful in saying that the victims are actually part of the problem as well. And, of course, we don't ever want it to happen to them, but a big part of this is that we assume that kids know how to communicate what they're feeling, and they really struggle with that. So I'll have a student that will come up to me and say, you know, this other student is doing this to me, and, you know, it bothers me. Oh, yeah, you know, I'll say, that sounds awful. Have you asked them to stop? And they'll look at me and just say, no. Oh, okay, we'll try that. Or, you know, they stop the behavior, but they're still feeling upset. So I'll say, oh, did you tell them how you feel? You know, that bothers me when you do that. That hurts my feelings when you call me that name. You know, did you say that to them? No. And then a really big piece, too, that they struggle with the most is the apology aspect. You know, they want an apology from the other student even after the bully behavior has stopped, but they want me to ask the child to apologize to them. They aren't comfortable asking for that apology themselves. So I work with kids to help empower them and to help them communicate more effectively so that they can solve these problems, you know, on their own and not need an adult all the time. And I think that if we can teach kids that very early on, we'll definitely have less problems and less bullying, because they can point out to other kids, you know, when someone's acting like a bully, and help them realize that within themselves. They really can just try it, just very simple steps, saying stop, telling how you feel, asking for an apology. And then, of course, they know that when those things don't work, they can tell an adult, because we want to make sure everybody feels safe and comfortable at school and at home. But I think they're great strategies for teachers to use, for parents to use with their kids and encourage them. And then with kids, it takes a lot of practice and modeling. And oftentimes I'll help students in the beginning of the year walk through their problems and just kind of facilitate their communication. And then this wonderful moment happens at some point in the year where they've seen it enough and feel a little bit more comfortable with it to start doing it on their own. And I will hear kids say, stop doing that. Even if it's something so small as tapping your pencil, stop tapping your pencil, or stop saying, I can't be part of your group. You know, that hurts my feelings when you do that. It's a really great, powerful thing to see the kids take that ownership and start to become more independent with those things.
Well, you can find out more about Diary of a Bully at Melody's website, which is melodyarabu.com, MelodyArabo.com. Melody, great talking with you.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
More women are studying mortuary science, and more people are entering the funeral business with no previous family members in the field. As we kick off our series, Living with Death, we begin by wondering just who is compelled to take these jobs. Kathleen Rogers is. She's a senior at Wayne State University's mortuary science program, and she's a funeral director's assistant in Dearborn. Kathleen, good to have you on the program.
Thank you for having me.
You actually switched majors, I understand, from nursing to mortuary science?
Yes. I had spent several years finishing up all the prerequisite coursework at a university in Livonia for nursing, and I really liked all of the science-based courses. So going into it, I was like, wow, I really like all these courses. I like the science. And I submitted my application, and then I shadowed a nurse at a hospital, and it did not feel what I thought it was going to feel like. And I said, wow, I don't think this is for me. And so I sort of had a little bit of a freak out going to school for so long and trying to redesign what I wanted to do and kind of starting from scratch again.
And what and how was the moment when you realized, wait, the funeral business, that's what I want to do?
Well, it kind of happened by chance. I decided to take a course at this university that was kind of based around medical professionals and kind of exploring what kind of fields are out there. Part of the coursework to complete the class was shadowing four different healthcare professionals. You know, I went from the nursing to radiology, and it still just wasn't a good fit. And I said, okay, well, let me examine what I really like doing and what I've liked in my coursework so far. I really loved my anatomy classes. And I said, okay, well, what can I do there? I like the human body. I like the physiology. I like understanding that sort of stuff. So my mom grew up with a funeral director who helps manage the Hal Peterson Funeral Home in Dearborn. And I called him up and I said, hey, can I come in and shadow you for an afternoon? And he was more than willing to show me around. He explained everything that was going on. Any questions I had had, he answered. I really saw the type of passion that he had was something I was looking for. He ended up offering me a job, and you know, I immediately accepted, and I said, sure, why not? I became a greeter. I work like evening visitations, welcoming families in, showing people which room that you know they've come for visitation, things like that. That sort of got me accustomed to the funeral service industry. So I started examining, okay, maybe I can do this. Maybe I can do this. But I was a little bit hesitant working with, you know, families who are grieving. That's sort of, you know, a big aspect of the job. And I said, I don't know if I can do that. I was still very unsure. So that's kind of what brought me into it.
Now you are a senior. You're going to get that degree in mortuary science and looking ahead to a career in the funeral service industry. As you say, you had the science background. You loved anatomy and physiology. Do you think you have come to terms with the fact that you're going to be working with grieving people? There's that whole, you know, there's the head and the heart.
Yeah. Just having that experience of being, you know, a greeter and working with families coming in really, really helped solidify my decision, and I felt very comfortable being a part of it and being a part of their memory. I had one experience with a funeral director here, and it was right before I decided to officially change my major. I was still tossing between being a funeral director and maybe doing something a little bit more clinical, a little bit more laboratory-based. I was very, very unsure, and again, it was that working with families. And we really kind of had like a slow weekend, and one of the funeral directors said, would you like to go on a transfer with me? Sure, I have nothing else to do, you know. So we went to a hospital, and we brought in this woman and brought her into our care. One of the things we do here is we keep the family in the loop, you know. We've brought your mother into our care, that sort of thing. And I really liked that. She was to be embalmed, and the funeral director asked, would you like to help me? And I said, oh, my gosh, yes. So I helped her with that. And I was working the next day, and she said, well, do you want to learn how to do some cosmetics? And I said, well, all right, you know, a little bit nervous and hesitant, but I said, all right, you know, let's dive in. And this woman, I remember her name, and I remember what she looked like. Mm-hmm. I just loved her. She came in from the hospital, you know, hospital gown, looking kind of sick. And we have a picture of her, and it's, you know, kind of our basis of what to go off of. This woman really, like, wore, you know, fire red engine, you know, lipstick and flashy nails, and that was what they wanted. That was what their memory was of her. When we finished cosmetizing her, that was her, you know, and it just was such a transformation, and I was in such awe, you know, and I thought, gosh, this is great. Later on that afternoon, the family came in to see her, and I worked the evening visitation with them, and it meant so much to the family to have that memory back, you know, and kind of reclaim it, you know, coming from the hospital and seeing her. You know, it's kind of sterile and sad in the hospital, and to come back and have that one last memory of her and what had always been their memory of her. At that moment, it was clear to me, this is what I can do. And I believe I changed my major that weekend.
I'm speaking with mortuary science major Kathleen Rogers, who's looking forward to a career in the funeral service industry. And I'm wondering, what did your friends and family think when you decided to switch from nursing to mortuary science? Because no one in the family had done that, had they?
Oh, no, not at all. My mom and my brother and my boyfriend, all incredibly supportive and really had helped guide me there and kind of, why didn't we think of this sooner? You know, my dad at first, a little bit more unsure, you know, well, somebody's got to do it. And at this point, he sees how passionate I am about it. And I work for an incredible family. And he's really proud of that. He's very proud to tell people what I'm doing. So it was a little bit of a mix with the family, but everyone is completely on board with it, and I have so much support, which is so great.
Kathleen, has working at the funeral home and taking these classes, has it changed the way you think and feel about death and dying?
Oh, completely, yeah. It is a little bit difficult. I've experienced very close deaths in my life, probably starting from when I was 20. For me, you know, it was always kind of, all right, well, this is something we have to, you know, deal with and go through. And now when I look at it, and I've even had, you know, recent deaths close to me just, you know, a few months ago, and as devastating as they can be, it's nice to have that last moment and that last, you know, take a deep breath and, you know, say your piece, and you kind of need that. Some people need that, and some people don't realize they do. And it's nice to be able to also be so involved with it that when someone else that you know needs you, you're able to supply that void, you know, and say, no, like, we can go through this and we can take it step by step and kind of just have someone you know and someone you care for kind of, you know, one foot in the door with you.
What about your own dying and your own eventual death? Do you think differently of it now?
You know, I don't think I thought much of it before. But no, I don't think I've changed. I don't think I was ever very scared or hesitant or avoided. But we do live in a very death-negative society. I am interested in sort of helping, you know, break that barrier and opening up that discussion with others. I mean, I have no problem kind of going there with them. And, you know, I do think, well, what would I want if I, you know, had passed away today? And, you know, I don't have an issue going through that. Actually, one of the courses I'm taking right now, you have to plan your own funeral. And I think that's sort of difficult for some people, easier for others. For myself, I find it kind of on the easier route. What I want, I know, might change over the years. So I'm kind of open to anything.
What are your career goals?
I am currently working at Howe Peterson. And after you finish your degree, you have to take two exams, your national board exam as well as a state exam. You also have to do an apprenticeship. So I hope to continue working at Howe Peterson and finish up my apprenticeship. I have a great group of mentors. I'm very fortunate to work with such caring and compassionate people who are willing to take a minute and teach someone new. Very, very fortunate for that. After that, I really strongly believe in continuing education, which currently isn't a requirement for your license. But there are a lot of opportunities to kind of grow with the changes in the industry. And I'm very much interested in keeping one foot in that and growing myself and learning about what's out there and what's new and networking with other people. So I see myself continuing doing that as well.
Kathleen, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Kathleen Rogers is a senior at Wayne State University's Mortuary Science Program, and she is an assistant at Howe Peterson Funeral Home in Dearborn. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's the most serious federal criminal case involving a Michigan charter school, and that's the assessment from the Michigan Department of Education. Traverse City optometrist Stephen Ingersoll is scheduled to go on trial tomorrow on 7 criminal charges of bank fraud and tax evasion. Reporter Chastity Pratt-Dossie has been digging into these charges and what led up to them in her story for Bridge Magazine. Chastity, who is Stephen Ingersoll?
Stephen Ingersoll, we call him a Traverse City businessman because he obviously started his first charter school in Traverse City. But he has a lot of business dealings in Bay City and a second charter school he founded there. Optometrist has some real estate development deals going on in Bay City that, have their own set of controversies attached to them. But he got in on charter schools very, very early. Started, I think, in 1996, developing his first charter school, the Grand Traverse Academy in Traverse City.
And then set up this management company called Smart Schools.
Right. Smart Schools Management is a full-service management company that essentially operates the two charter school, or operated, I should say, founded the two charter schools, the Grand Traverse Academy and the Bay City Academy.
And Grand Traverse Academy and Bay City Academy are founded on some ideas that Stephen Ingersoll has about education?
Right. Again, he's optometrist by profession, and he developed a theory called integrated visual learning. And essentially, it's visual therapy, it's light therapy, mixed with some cognitive methodology and therapies. Really, what they're saying is better visual thinking leads to better learning. If you can visualize and understand what you see, then you'll be a better learner. And some of his, I guess, literature about integrated visual learning, they claim to have assessed and addressed learning disabilities like ADHD with this, theory and methodology.
And he brought in Lake Superior State University as his authorizer.
Correct.
How has that relationship gone?
Well, Lake Superior State is one of the 11 authorizers that the Michigan Department of Education is considering suspending because of issues with either academics or oversight. So
they're on the thin ice list.
They're
with
on
the
thin ice list with the Department of Education, yes.
How did Stephen Ingersoll come to be in the center of this huge fraud trial?
It actually started, the FBI, the federal investigators, got onto it because when he was looking to start Bay City Academy back in 2010, 2011, he took out a construction loan. And it was for $1.8 million. That construction deal involved his brother, who was a subcontractor, and some other partners. So they were going to turn a church in Bay City into a school for Bay City Academy, going back 2010, 2011. Borrowed $1.4 million. Well, the feds alleged that he took some of that money through several different channels. He and his wife and his brother and some friends took some of that money that was loaned to construct Bay City Academy and funneled it into his personal joint bank account and used that money to pay back the Grand Traverse Academy. Yeah, you're looking at me strange today. The feds are saying he robbed Peter to pay Paul.
My mother used to say that all the time.
Right. Your mother's analogy would fit here. The feds are alleging that he took money from Grand Traverse Academy because he had access to their account. Mm-hmm. He prepaid himself. He advanced himself, and he owed them money back. And so he took some of this construction money from one charter school and paid back the other charter school. It's complicated, and that's the simple version.
As I read your story for Pridge, Ingersoll's attorney says, we did all of that. And by the way, it's legal.
His attorney in Traverse City, Jan Getz, says they don't refute the feds' allegations for how the money moved. But they say, look, in the state of Michigan, charter schools are a public-private partnership. And as the management company, yes, he had access to their funds. Their audits worked out every year. What's the problem?
And the schools now have cut their ties with Smart Schools Management. But I gather from reading your story, board members, who a lot of them are, by the way, optometrists, I noticed, are still supporting Stephen Ingersoll.
So Bay City Academy, I think they still have Smart Schools, but Stephen Ingersoll, apparently stepped down from being involved in running their operations at Bay City. Grand Traverse Academy cut ties with him altogether. A federal investigation will do that.
Yes.
And at that instance, essentially, with Grand Traverse being you know, mentioned all up and through that indictment, they cut ties with him. However, one of his business associates continues to manage it with a new management company.
I am talking with reporter Chastity Pratt-Dossie about her story for Bridge Magazine, looking at what's been called the most serious federal criminal case that involves a Michigan charter school since the state okayed charter schools in 1994, as we look at the impending trial of Traverse City businessman optometrist Stephen Ingersoll. You note in your story for Bridge, Chastity, this case comes pretty hard on the heels of the huge series of stories that Detroit Free Press did that looked at the nearly $1 billion in state taxpayer money that the charter schools get with very little accountability or transparency over that, how the money is used. So how is this case playing with both critics and supporters of charter schools?
Well, the supporters are saying, you know, we have accountability. The fact that the school board and Grand Traverse cut ties with him, the fact that the authorizer asked some hard questions, this shows that we have accountability. You got to let the process play itself out. Well, critics are saying, how can someone put their hands into a taxpayer-funded budget, just advance themselves money and spend it how they want to and say it's okay? There should be more controls. There should be more oversight. So
because it seems that if indeed the jury in this trial prove and support what Ingersoll's lawyer says, which is, well, it's legal, then it means that the way state law exists now, basically these folks can use the charter school operators can use the money like their personal sandbox.
Well, that is yet to be determined in court, I assume. Charles Brunner, Representative Charles Brunner from Bay City, he was onto this right before it actually hit the indictment. And he used to be a teacher, and he's really, really a strong critic of charter schools. And he's like crazy angry about this, apoplectic, like banging his head against the wall, saying that this shouldn't stand, this sort of access to public funds. Because in a lot of charter schools, they pay 3% of the state revenues that go into a school to the authorizer for administrative fees. And they take the rest and it goes into the management company's budget, and the management company just uses it to run the school. Now, once money goes into a management company's hands, it goes behind the privacy veil of private corporations, and you can't really see how it's spent. And that's another issue that was brought up in the Free Press series, another issue that Representative Charles Brunner brings up. When a management company accesses a charter school's funds, removes it from their budget, the school's budget, and puts it into their bank accounts, all deals are off. You can't really see what happens with it.
What could happen, do you think, if this trial goes forward? It's beginning February the 10th?
Yes.
And Stephen Ingersoll is found guilty of bank fraud and tax evasion. What might we see happen as far as the push to reform Michigan's charter school laws?
Well, the Democrat, and there's largely Democrats who are pushing for charter school accountability and charter school reform are continuing to do so. Mm-hmm. I would, just talking to Charles Brunner and a few of the others, I would suspect that they would just, you know, continue to push it. Right now, the Republican-led legislature has not moved on any of the Democratic bills to improve or increase accountability in charter schools. So you'll continue to see, I believe, the Democrats push for it. But whether or not the Republican legislature is going to respond is yet to be seen.
Chastity Pratt-Dossie is a reporter for Bridge Magazine. Her big education story on the upcoming fraud trial of charter school operator Stephen Ingersoll can be found at bridgemi.com. Thank you so much, Chastity.
Anytime.
A newly released report finds that millions of cars and trucks could be vulnerable to being hacked. Auto analyst John McElroy is here. He is host of the AutoLine Daily webcast. John, this report was directed by Senator Ed Markey, Democrat from Massachusetts. So that kind of tells us Congress thinks this hacking is a real threat?
Well, they are. And, you know, they're a little bit late to the party in the sense that this has been known for a number of years now that cars could be hacked. And not just hacked by somehow sneaking into a car and wiring up something that would allow you to take control of it. There are at least a half a dozen ways to wirelessly hack into a car remotely. There's been some very good research papers and even some very good YouTube videos on all this. So it's good to see that the U.S. government is catching up to all of it.
Give us a sense, what kinds of gateways are there? How are they getting in and able to hack a vehicle?
It's amazing. It's amazing where you can get into a car. So, for example, Bluetooth. When you pair your phone to your car, that's all done wirelessly. Somebody can sniff out your Bluetooth protocol and get into your car that way. Another way, these remote key fobs where you just have to push a button on your fob to lock or unlock your car. In some modern cars, even newer cars, I should say, as soon as you walk up to the door handle and touch it, as long as the key fob is in your pocket, it will unlock the car. And again, wireless way for hackers to get in. Another thing, and this is crazy, people don't realize that there is a wireless tire pressure monitoring system on all new cars. And it will let you know if your tires are underinflated or even overinflated.
Yeah.
And this has been a move by the government to try to get everybody to properly inflate their tires, which if we did, by the way, as a nation, we could reduce our oil dependence so much that we could get off of Saudi Arabia's oil. But that tire pressure monitoring system is another way in. Another way is through Wi-Fi. More and more cars are becoming available with that. General Motors is making a big deal out of having 4G LTE. Another way, corrupted song files.
Hmm.
Somebody could put malware into a song file, use social media to entice you to say, hey, check out the sound, download it and play it in your car. Boom. Once you get on what they call the CAN, the controller area network, this is the electronic nervous system that controls everything in a car. Once you're on the CAN, you're in, and now you can control just about anything on an automobile.
John, are there any known cases of someone's car actually being hacked and taken over?
No, none that, you know, were done by the bad guys, so to speak.
Sure.
As I said, there's been college kids and university researchers and others who have made their own YouTube videos very crudely hacking into a car. To my knowledge, there is no case of malfeasance, i.e. bad guys trying to hack into your car and do bad things with it.
Last month came that announcement from Germany of that security flaw that could have opened up over 2 million BMWs, Minis, and Rolls-Royces to being unlocked by hackers because of BMW's connected drive. So are we to be wary of things like connected drive or OnStar or these wireless networks?
I wouldn't worry for right now, because even though it is possible for hackers to get into a car wirelessly, once they're in, man, it's a huge task to reverse engineer all the software in a car. And remember, there's all different kinds of softwares for the steering, for the transmission, for the engine, for the brakes, and it goes on and on and on. So to really competently take control of a car takes a lot of time, and time is money. It's probably right now just too expensive for hackers to be able to do it. However, people love to hack. And the bad guys love sharing their knowledge and practices, their procedures of how to get in. And as more and more of this knowledge gets shared, it's going to become only easier and faster to hack into a car.
Just like we've seen with our personal computers. So the challenge seems to lie for the automakers and their engineers to make this stuff, design it so it's less vulnerable to hacking.
It is, and there's various steps that you can do. I mean, it starts with even the servers, not even on the cars themselves, but servers that can have firewalls. Additionally, putting firewalls into cars as well. But that's clearly not going to be enough. Firewalls can be worked around. What's needed right now is some way of identifying bad commands in a car, even if they make all the sense in the world. It might just say, oh, unlock the doors. Well, maybe that's not a good thing if you're going 70 miles an hour. But what I'm getting at is that the industry is at a crossroads right now. Everybody's working on this problem, but how do you solve it? Do you put additional hardware on a car that will try to block hackers? Or, and this is even more interesting, can you put in software patches that can alert you of an attack and make sure bad things don't happen to your car? But even if you do those things, go with new hardware and or some sort of software patch that protects you, the hackers will be able to break it. So you're going to need to be able to update these things. And in fact, what some of the cybersecurity experts have told me is that getting your cybersecurity software updated in your car is going to become as common as getting an oil change.
Auto analyst John McElroy giving us a look at the brave new world of wireless hacking in our vehicles. He's host of AutoLine Daily Webcast. John, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
It can often be kind of hard to imagine just how much the latest innovations will really change our lives. The contributions of smartphones, for example, well, those are very, very obvious. Segways, not so much. But as we've been talking about, new technology in the auto industry does seem to be impacting us in a big way. In our latest segment for The Next Idea, executive producer Joe Lindstroth speaks with John Lochner, GM's chief technology officer. They dig into everything from driverless cars and 3D printers to green technology and young drivers' changing relationships with cars. You can easily take a listen online. Just head to The Next Idea page at michiganradio.org. And here at Stateside, we always want to hear from you. What's going on in your mind? What stories do you want to hear more about? Just let us know. You can tweet at us at Stateside Radio or on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. Today's program was directed by Allie Billings. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, Annie Norris, Ari Sandberg, and Lindsay Scullin. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.